Accession number 26868, Reel 4.
That the RAF would train some of the Egyptian pilots. Anyway, when I was back in Egypt again, after that interval, Montgomery was well on the way to forcing Rommel out of Africa, with the aid of the 5th Army coming in from Algeria.
In relation to how the Germans had been going, and we'd heard of Tobruk, for instance, falling to the Germans, what was the attitude when that had happened? I understand that South Africans were seen as primary cause of the loss of Tobruk.
Got very little information on that. Very little. In fact, information on how the war was going was generally very, very scarce. You just hoped.
In relation to the situation, obviously the knowledge of the Japanese were in the war, did you know of their air power?
Not really. We heard that the Zero was one that you, the aircraft that we had, Hurricanes and Spitfires and so on, you didn't get into a dogfight with the Zero because it was so light, it turned inside everything. It was a very high power-weight ratio, which made it so manoeuvrable and fast that you just avoided a dogfight. That's about all we knew. We knew that the bombers were going. We didn't even know about Darwin being bombed or anything like that, or where they were in the islands. We did hear that the Repulse and Renown were sunk, and Singapore had fallen.
We'd spoken a little bit about that before in relation to heading off. I wanted to talk about your further career from this point. You mentioned you were in Hurricane and then in Spitfires.
Well, I was then posted when I finished my course at the 74 OTU. I was posted to Malta, and because it was just about the Sicilian landing, and to 1437 Strategic Reconnaissance Flight, which was a small flight, which had the early Mustang aircraft, which was then known as the A-36. It had dive brakes like a Stuka, which were never used, and an Allison engine. It had quite a lot of performance at low level, but was pretty hopeless at any height at all. Well, they had a couple of Spitfires, and I'd been flying Spitz. I had 3 hours or something other on Spitz. I was allocated to the Spitz, so I didn't fly the A-36s. I did odd things with the Spitz. And then we ran out of aircraft, and there was no aircraft to replace it, so the whole flight was disbanded, and I joined a Spitfire squadron, 225 squadron, RAF, which was on what was normally called Army Reconnaissance or Tactical Reconnaissance, as opposed to the Strategic Reconnaissance flight. And the 225 squadron had come out with the lot to Algeria and had moved with the, was it the 5th Army, I think, driving the Germans out of North Africa when they were meeting up with the 8th Army of Montgomery. And so I joined these people. And now...
Was this to be your first operational flying?
Yes.
When was... So that... 43-4?
Yes, 43. Yes, 43. What the main purpose of the unit was, gaining information so the army, the 8th Army, could make the best use of it. And there'd been a shortage of pilots in this because there were more casualties in this than in fighter command. And there was a reason for that. You were based near the Germans because the Spit only had 90-gallon tank, so it really only had about an hour and a quarter in the air until you had to get down again. So you had to be very close to the what was called the bomb line between the two armies. And so that 5 minutes after takeoff, you were over enemy territory. And that continued until 5 minutes before landing. And the losses had been so high on the TACAR that they reduced the tour of operation time to 50% of what it was on fighter command, plain fighter squadrons, because they had so much more time cruising around. So what happened was there was one chap who was the lead that flew in pairs. The leader was the one who was writing down all the various things he could pick up on the ground to pass on immediately to the army. And his number two was the one who was a weaver, trying to keep him safe because he wasn't capable of keeping himself up to date with what was behind him because he was looking at the ground. And so when you joined the squadron, you went as a weaver to start with. So I went as a weaver on only a few trips, and then I became a leader.
In relation to working in this sort of team effort, how strong was camaraderie within the flight crew?
Oh, good. All the people were commissioned. There were no sergeant pilots. The reason for that was that we had to deal with the army liaison officers, who were all captains or majors. And the army's way of dealing with non-commissioned officers wasn't that of the Air Force. So to get over the difficulty, they had all commissioned crew, air crew. Sounds silly, but there it was. So when you landed with your information, you immediately went to the ops room where the army liaison officer was and passed on all the information to him, and he then dealt with it to the army.
In relation to this working together, were there ever times when teams just couldn't work together, that individuals just couldn't get on with one another?
Not after the initial start. If a fellow came in and he just wouldn't listen to what he was told and disobeyed various standing orders and so on, well, they got chucked out, sent somewhere else onto a communications flight or something like that. So that after a while, if a person had been on the squad, we all got on well. There was no time to run into trouble. Trouble, yes, but they were chucked out quickly. I'll come to that later.
Okay. In relation to making sort of bonds within the Air Force. I understand that quite often people would try and avoid getting too close to one another because you never knew when that person might not be around, as it were.
There was a very small amount of that, but generally no. You didn't stick with friends very much in fighter or tactical reconnaissance command because you, when you finished your tour of operations, you were sent for what they call a rest tour, which was usually instructing or some other thing, perhaps communications might be, or transport things. So it was very difficult to keep together. But on 225 Squadron, I met up with another Australian who was on number one course from Australia to Rhodesia, Charlie Edmondson. And we managed to stick for nearly 2 years. If we weren't on the same squadron, we were near each other.
How did you, obviously working up to your first operational flight, how did you sort of work through the idea that you were actually going to the danger zone now?
You knew it was going to come, so I think you were conditioned to the thought of it. Now on that, there's no quid, but most of the thing you got to the squadron were people telling you what to do, what not to do, and what would happen here and what would happen there. And then you had to go up and make the use of it. Well, the first thing that you got was, even though you'd been told about the extent of the anti-aircraft fire, that was where most of the on tactical reconnaissance, where 99% of the losses were caused by that, because you had the different levels of ACAC. You had the small and lighter ACAC, which carried on up to about 6,000 feet. That was the extreme one. And then you had the 88mm ACAC, which was absolutely marvellous guns. They were the same guns as were in the Tiger tank, the German Tiger tank. And they shot four shells together. And if you went straight for 20 seconds, 30 seconds, you're a goner. They were so quick, they were onto you all the time, and you had to be outmaneuvering them because they had these clockwork fuses, and they had you, they'd guess your direction, and they had the height right spot on. And there was this poof, and four great black bursts and shrapnel flying all sorts of directions and so on. It was frightening stuff. So that most of the losses on these squadrons was purely ACAC. So your first flight as a weaver, a number two, didn't get very far, and suddenly there was, you could see the bullets coming up from down below, and they're going past you in all directions. It was rather like hail, but illuminated a bit. You thought, God, you can't bloody well last in this. But it went on, and you didn't get hit. You know. So you waked yourself up pretty quickly and got onto manoeuvring, which was changing direction and height and irregular. You didn't do a regular weave or anything like that because that just didn't work. But you were trying to do that and watch your number one. So it became a fairly interesting situation. And as number one, well, you're watching the ground and so on, but at the same time you had to still do this irregular weaving, and your poor weaver had to try and sort of stick somewhere near you to protect you in case of aircraft coming in. I mentioned the 88 millimetre and the power of these things. I'd been weaving, and I had a rather interesting lot of German stuff below. And they were much, we were trying to protect this. And I thought I'd outmaneuvered them, and there was this colossal bang, and I did almost a bunt. You know, a bunt is an outside loop, which is not good because you burst your blood vessels in your eyes and all sorts of things because of the G the wrong way. Well, I was like that. The plane just tipped, so I was too going down vertically.
Sorry, continue.
Right, well, I quickly got out of going down vertically and carried on with my recce because I didn't seem to be anything wrong in the aircraft. I couldn't see anything wrong from the rear vision mirror and so on and looking around. So I carried on, and eventually after that trip I landed, and I told the flight sergeant about it and the fitters and riggers and so on. They all looked at me as though, because they couldn't find anything wrong on the plane, more or less appeared as though they thought, well, he's making this up. So, all right. So I slung my parachute over my shoulder, started to walk off, and then somebody yelled out, sir, come back. Came back, and he said, come and have a look at this. So I went to the tailplane and started tapping the tailplane. And the paint just fell off it. The concussion had been so strong that the paint just fell off the plane, the elevators and rudder and so on. But I didn't get any holes from shrapnel, which was very lucky. So I learnt the lesson to be a little bit more enthusiastic on my evasive actions.
In relation to, you know, having to, as you mentioned, having to approach this, what looks like hail, a little bit illuminated, coming up as opposed to going down, how do you sort of steel yourself against that sort of situation?
I don't know, you just do. You haven't got much option, have you? Apart from turning tail and waving the white flag.
Were there people that just couldn't cope?
There were some, yeah.
What happened to them?
Well, there was one, whenever this was on fighter works, whenever he got near any other plane, he suddenly disappeared. And they caught him several times coming into the aerodrome from the wrong direction. And as he was the commanding officer, it wasn't all that good. There was a bit of nonsense over that, but I'll skip over that one. There was another story, because my friend of later years was in the air at the time when this happened. It was over Benghazi. People flying Marylands, which was the forerunner of the Baltimore, a twin-engine bomber. And he was flying about 30-something thousand feet, the pilot, and he could see the German aircraft taking off down below him. And he started to panic, so he said, I'm getting out of here. So he put the nose down. And this plane got up speed very quickly, and as you get up speed, your trim alters, and it automatically brings it up. Well, with him panicking and this, down it went, up, a loop, and back down again. And the poor observer in the front was trying to talk him, and this was coming out over the radio to all the planes nearby. Oh, Christ, he's done it again. Now he's off. He did 13 loops over Benghazi before he took off home. And he got away with it. Mind you, he got flung out straight away. He was out on LMF, lack of moral fibre.
How did people see, other crew, see other airmen see people that weren't able to cope?
Get rid of the rubbish. Had to be, because you had to have faith in your co-pilots. I'll come to one or two others later on. Now, I've dealt a little bit with the ACAG then.
You're talking about weaving, and you mentioned, obviously, going from the weaving to being a leader, number one. What was that like?
Oh, I think, if anything, it was easier. But you did need good eyesight. I found that a lot of people didn't have good enough eyesight from, say, 9,000, 10,000 feet to be able to pick up things there.
So from 9,000 or 10,000 feet, what were you expected to be able to see?
Well, you could pick up motor transports and so on. You could pick up troops from that. Anything that was moving, more or less, you know, above, say, well, a truck size.
Presumably you had to know whether that was enemy truck?
Well, you knew where the bomb line was, and you knew which was and which wasn't. So if it was in that area, it was enemy. Right, well,
what were some of the bigger observation movements, troop movements, truck movements, that you were to recall from those days that you saw?
Well, the odd panzer movement of tanks and so on. Usually it was trucks. 10 to 20 or so moving in such a direction, the odd guns being towed and so on. I think I should mention just at one stage there that I had a peculiar little time where I was given plane, a warrant officer with a truck and a couple of fitters and riggers and a cook and so on, and I had a detachment. Me is the one pilot and the one plane, and I went round part of Italy to going on airfields which were no further than here to the kitchen wide. bulldozer blade, some of them, which was very difficult with a Spitfire because you couldn't see because of the engine in front of you, landing on those. And that was quite an interesting time because I was with the war correspondents and so on, right with the troops in the front line. As they moved, I moved with my little setup. And eventually I joined back with the squadron at a place called Foggia in Italy. And shortly after this, there was a bit of panic. Got to have this done quickly. And who can do oblique line overlap? Well, I was the only one on the squadron who'd done it, although the people had been on the squadron much longer, so I had this job. And then I found what it was. It was a line overlap at low level, you know, about 200 feet, a whole lot of German airfields and so on. It was sounded like a really suicide mission. Up the Moesta River into Yugoslavia. Now, I'll give you the reason for this, we found out later. If you know of the records, Churchill didn't want the Russians to move through Germany. He wanted to cut off, and he didn't want the D-Day landing to be in France. He wanted to cut off the Russians. and he was looking for an alternate route. And this was going to go back straight to Churchill and his advisers of this in case they could make a landing there. Well, I was set up on my own for this. I had my camera set up and so on. And then they decided with the sort of suicide extent of this mission, they gave me a full squadron of cover. So I had 12 Spits above me as I did this. And when I went over the airfields and so on, I didn't get shot at. No aircraft took off. They're all looking at the ones on top. But when I got to the mountains where the Mahasta River started, I had to turn around and do the same thing back from the other direction. Again, I went through without being shot at. I think there was some small arms fire, but I didn't see it. So that was an interesting trip. And not long after that, we were suddenly moved from the Adriatic side of Italy to Naples. We didn't know why, but we were put there. And then we were told there was the Anzio landing was imminent.